Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federal Society virtual event. My name is Marco J. Lloyd, and I'm Assistant Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. Today, we're excited to host a webinar, Ethics or Ideology? Bar Associations and the Boundaries of Professional Discipline. Our moderator today is Professor Denise Hartley. Professor Hartley is a clinical professor and director of the First Amendment Clinic at FSU College of Law, where she leads student advocacy and litigation on free speech, religious liberty, and press freedom issues. Her teaching and scholarship focuses on constitutional law, appellate practice, and First Amendment rights. Before entering academia, Professor Hartley was a partner at Schutz & Bowen LLP in Tallahassee, where she was a member of the firm's appellate practice group and constitutional law practice area. Prior to that, she served as Deputy Solicitor General in the Office of the Florida Attorney General. Professor Hartley has briefed and argued high-profile cases involving significant constitutional issues and questions of statutory interpretation in both state and federal courts, including the U.S. Supreme Court. If you'd like to learn more about today's speakers, their full bios can be viewed on our website, fedsoc.org. If you have a question at any point in today's program, please enter it into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window, and we'll do our best to answer as many as we can. Finally, I'll note that, as always, the Federal Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues, and all expressions of opinion are those of the speakers. With that, Professor, thank you for joining us today, and the floor is yours.
Thank you, Marco. Well, I'm excited to introduce our panelists today, most of whom are probably not strangers to the audience. I will just briefly give you a condensed version of their bios, which are long and accomplished. So starting with James Burnham, he's the founder and managing partner of King Street Legal, PLLC, and president of Vallecito Capital, LLC. James recently returned to King Street Legal after serving for 6 months as general counsel for the Department of Government Efficiency, which you might know as DOGE. Before founding King Street Legal, James was a litigation partner at Jones Day, a senior official in the Department of Justice's Civil Division and Office of the Attorney General, and a senior associate counsel to President Trump. Next, we have Michael Francisco, who currently serves as partner at First and 14th PLLC, where he handles public, commercial, and constitutional litigation. Prior to joining First and 14th, Michael was a partner at McGuire Woods in Washington, D.C., representing litigation, white-collar, and government investigation clients. Michael has also served as a partner at MRD Law and as the Assistant Solicitor General of Colorado. Next, we have Gene Hamilton. He's the president of America First Legal, which he co-founded, and where he was previously the executive director, executive vice president, and general counsel. Before that, Gene served as deputy White House counsel to President Trump. Early in his career, Gene served as counselor to the Attorney General at the U.S. Department of Justice and as senior counselor to the Secretary of Homeland Security. He also served as general counsel to the Senate Judiciary Committee and held several roles at the Department of Homeland Security, including U.S. Immigration Enforcement, U.S. Customs and Border Protection, and in the Office of the General Counsel. And finally, we have Professor Derek Mueller, who is a professor of law at Notre Dame Law School, where he teaches election law, civil procedure, and evidence. His research focuses on the role of states in the administration of federal elections, the constitutional contours of voting rights and election administration, the limits of judicial power in the domain of elections, and the Electoral College. Professor Mueller has published more than 24 academic works, and his op-eds have appeared in the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, and the Wall Street Journal. He's also testified before Congress, and he's a contributor at the Election Law Blog. Professor Mueller is a co-author on a federal court's casebook published by the Carolina Academic Press. He's also the co-reporter on the new restatement of the law election litigation led by the American Law Institute. And with that, we'll turn it back to our panelists for some opening remarks to give us some of their thoughts on this hot topic today. So we'll start with you, James.
Thanks, Denise. I appreciate it. So I'm going to cover three things. The ongoing bar proceedings against Jeff Clark, whom I've known for nearly a decade, and I'm going to cover that in a bit of detail because I think it's very important. New efforts to weaponize the bar against DOJ lawyers, and then a few small thoughts on what to make of it. So to start with Jeff, I mean, I think the first thing we have to do is put ourselves back in the December of 2020. Everyone on this call, you know, I'm sure was paying close attention to the proceedings following the election that November. It was crazy. I mean, it was a crazy time on many levels. We were something like 8 months, 9 months into COVID, and there were just allegations everywhere. There was all kinds of evidence pointing in all sorts of directions. And this was a very, very intense and passionate time for the country. And I think it is very hard to think about anything that happened without remembering what that time was like. And the prospect, which had been asserted, that the greatest crime in American history, the theft of an American election, a presidential election, had just happened. And so I want to situate you, and now I'm going to try to describe the facts, although you can probably guess how I feel about what's happening, in a somewhat dispassionate way, because I actually think they speak for themselves. So where are we? In July of 2022, about a year and a half, if I'm doing the math right, after the conduct in question, the DC Bar of, Office of Disciplinary Counsel filed charges against Jeff, accusing him of violating rules 8.4 A, C, and D of the DC Rules of Professional Conduct. The basic allegation centered on things that Jeff had done when he was a senior DOJ official in connection with the 2020 election. And the core accusation was that he had engaged in dishonest conduct by drafting a draft letter that was had been drafted to be sent by DOJ to Georgia, raising significant concerns about election fraud and encouraging the legislature to do some various things to remediate those problems. Now, I want to make clear at the outset, the letter was never sent. So the entire proceeding is about so-called false statements on an internal draft circulated among senior DOJ officials. And because it was never sent, they've had to shoehorn this into a so-called attempt under Rule 8.4C to make claims that they claim are intentionally false statements. Okay, that's the gravamen of their allegation. So let's cover what Jeff has said in response to that. And as best I can tell, I'm sure I'm not doing it full justice, but there's sort of four basic responses, and I'm going to just kind of summarize them to give you a sense of what his arguments are on the other side. So the first and foremost point he's made is, look, he had a good faith belief that there were serious problems and irregularities in the election. That's important, because if he had a good faith belief, then we don't even have to think about all the other issues here, because that means the letter was drafted on the basis of a good faith belief. Now, what the bar has said is that he couldn't have had a good faith belief because other DOJ officials told him there was no fraud. But what he said is that he engaged in his own assessment of the issues. He had done his own investigation, and he did not agree with that and had a good faith belief that there were serious issues. Other DOJ officials are certainly entitled to their view of the facts, but I think it is, but so of course is Jeff. Jeff also took an oath to uphold the Constitution. And frankly, I think it's rather audacious to think that anybody in the middle of December in 2020 had perfect knowledge or even complete or even somewhat complete knowledge of what exactly had happened in that election. We're talking about millions of votes in many states, and the idea that there was sort of biblical truth in mid-December is something that I find very hard to believe. So that's the first point they've made. The second point is that this letter was just a draft, which I mentioned at the beginning. It was never sent. It was part of internal legal deliberations within the Justice Department. Now, such drafts, in addition to only being prefatory, in other words, to spark a conversation, are typically protected by attorney-client privilege. At DOJ, they're often protected by executive privilege and other sorts of privileges. These are privileged communications that are internal to the Justice Department when the Justice Department engages in strategizing about what they are supposed to do. What is the right course of action? That's what this letter was. It was something to prompt a conversation. At least that's how Jeff described it. And that aligns with my understanding from the outside. I wasn't at DOJ anymore when this happened. My understanding from the outside about the facts. Those are kind of the two main substantive arguments, but then there's some procedural and constitutional points too. So the procedural and constitutional points are that the DC bar's disciplinary process is basically unconstitutional and biased. It's unconstitutional because it's reaching in to try to govern what the president's lawyers do inside the department. And it's biased because the DC bar has a political bias against him and basically is trying to persecute him under the guise of an ethics violation. It's also put him in a terrible position because of different lawfare against him in Georgia, which everyone is familiar with. I don't think, we all know about that case. As a result of that, Jeff has had to invoke his Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination here in the DC bar. bar. So they're coming after his license at the same time that different enforcement officials in Georgia are trying to go after his liberty, which is not a position anyone wants to be in, particularly for some internal letter at DOJ. And then the final one, of course, is that this is politically motivated, and it's really not about ethics violations. It's not really about making sure that lawyers are scrupulous in their drafts. It's about going after people associated with Donald Trump who, were not willing to just accept the sort of conventional wisdom in mid-November that the election was hunky-dory and everything was fine. He's argued, and I think this is a very plausible argument in light of the D.C. bar's conduct and the composition of the bar, that what this is really about is punishing dissenting legal opinions and chilling federal attorneys' ability to advise government officials. So look, where does that leave us? I'm going to get to the big picture concerns in a minute about how the bars interact with federal government lawyers. But even on a very narrow level, this just strikes me as a massive overreach by the DC bar. Senior DOJ officials like Jeff, who at the time was running two components, the environmental division and the civil division, have a constitutional obligation to enforce the law. If they think that massive illegality has occurred, and truly it is hard to imagine a greater crime than rigging a presidential election, they have a constitutional obligation, legal obligation to run that down. Part of running that down is drafting internal correspondence, suggesting courses of action, and the like. The last thing we want is people inside the department, inside the federal government, afraid to do their jobs because they're worried that certain prevailing wisdoms among some sectors are going to come down and take away their livelihood because they leaned in on something where they had a good faith belief that something horrible had happened. I think that is just not a world that we want to live in, totally divorced from politics. And if we even assume, which I don't assume, that it's appropriate for state or DC bar to regulate federal officials. Okay, that's Jeff. There's a second issue, which is having, had so much fun torturing Jeff Clark, the DC bar is now, people are now trying to weaponize the DC bar against other DOJ officials. So I forget the name of the group. I should have brought it with me. But there's a left-wing pop-up group that is now filing bar complaints against all kinds of people in the civil division, career lawyers, political lawyers. This thing is not a litigant. It is not a party to these cases. It is reading the New York Times and running around and filing bar complaints based on things that it thinks happened in various civil litigations. This is a huge problem for DOJ. The most senior people at DOJ unfortunately have to sort of expect a certain level of harassment when they take those jobs because that's just, unfortunately, the world that we live in. Line lawyers in federal programs don't. These are people that are making, mid to high $100,000, $150,000, $175,000. Yeah, it's a lot of money. Not a lot of money for a really highly credentialed lawyer. They work really hard. They are not the president's political appointees. Many of them are probably not aligned with the president or don't even have a particular political view. And now after working, 12 hours a day, 7 days a week, all year trying to defend the president's initiatives, they're getting inundated with this garbage that requires them to go defend their livelihoods in front of the DC bar. Not a good dynamic. It needs to be shut down immediately. And so that brings me to the big picture, and then I'll pass the torch. Why are state bars involved in this at all? So there's a statute. These are federal officials that work for the federal government. Normally, they're immune to state regulation. There's a whole concept called federal officer immunity that says the states cannot regulate federal officers discharging federal functions. Well, there's a statute that only goes back to 1998, thank you, Janet Reno, that says, quote, an attorney for the government shall be subject to state laws and rules and local federal court rules governing attorneys in each state where such attorney engages in that attorney's duties to the same extent and in the same manner as other attorneys in that state. There's actually a real question about whether this includes DC, because DC, of course, is not a state. And I think there are very good arguments that DC actually is not able to do this because they're not within the provision. But let's put that aside. Let's also put aside the wisdom of the statute. As you can guess, I don't think it's a very wise statute. Is it constitutional? Does Congress actually have the ability to enlist state bars, which report to state Supreme Courts, in the regulation of ethical conduct for federal lawyers who represent the president and have an Article II obligation to represent the president zealously and aggressively? There's another statute that gives the Attorney General the statutory authority to send whomever she wants into court on behalf of the United States. How can state bars and state Supreme Courts possibly interfere with that? How can Congress interfere with that? I don't think Congress could pass a statute that says the president's not entitled to any lawyers. I don't think they could say the president's not allowed to appear in court. And so I don't understand why, or at least I think there's a plausible argument that Congress similarly cannot sort of conscript state bars in a similar effort to interfere with how these lawyers do their jobs. So as you can see, I don't think this is a tenable situation. I think DOJ needs to take all action to get involved and to remedy the situation. And I think Jeff's ongoing proceeding and God forbid future proceedings against these other folks are the right place for DOJ to get involved. Thank you.
Thanks, James, for the really helpful unpacking of some of the facts there. Michael, we'll go to you next. Give us some of your initial thoughts on this topic.
Yes, happy to be a participant here on a very important subject. I'm going to talk about what's happened recently to the Solicitor General in Montana and others, as well as the Attorney General of Montana. Before I get started, I just want to say that this is a really important subject for anybody who engages in ideological or politically fraught litigation, i.e. anybody who doesn't make their living as a lawyer working for Bank of America and Coca-Cola. This is what causes me to lose sleep at night. It's not worrying about losing a case in court. It's not even worrying about clients failing to pay their bill, and it's not messing up legal arguments. What I worry about is having my ability to practice law taken away because of the types of cases that I engage in. And it's not a hypothetical risk, given what we've seen all across the country. So let's start with now Judge Van Dyke's situation when he was the Solicitor General of Nevada. As an interesting side note, Lawrence Van Dyke was attending a Federal Society conference in D.C. about the overregulation of occupational licensing when he received a call that the Montana bar authorities were revoking his license to practice law in Montana in 2 days. They gave him 2 days notice with no hearing. And the reason for that, they went after three attorneys in the Attorney General Adam Laxalt's office. And they said that a waiver that they were operating under was only limited to 1 year, not multiple years of practice. Well, as it turns out, the attorneys had been aware of this rule, and Lawrence Van Dyke did not take his own conclusion in reading the Montana rule, which could be interpreted to apply only for 1 year or to apply for multiple years. He called up the bar authorities in Nevada and said, "How do you interpret this rule?" And they told him, "Oh, no, no, we absolutely interpret this to apply for multiple years. You don't need to take the bar now. You have more years left on your waiver." And being a decently good attorney, Lawrence Van Dyke asked them to confirm this in writing in an email, which they did. And those attorneys relied on that email in delaying taking the Nevada bar and having this waiver operate. This dispute ended up going up to the Nevada Supreme Court. It resulted in a 4-3 ruling where they barely retained their law licenses, nunc pro tunc. And the dissenter's opinion is quite remarkable. The three dissenters said that the Nevada Bar Authority's interpretation of Nevada's attorney regulation rules was so wrong that these attorneys were unreasonable in relying on the bar's written assurance of what the rule means. So you have to think about that. The Supreme Court governs the Office of Attorney Regulation in Nevada. And sorry if I keep saying Montana, I forget which state of Lawrence Van Dyke's Solicitor General this we're talking about. But their own regulators, they're throwing under the bus and saying it was unreasonable to rely on them. So that's one example of what is, I think, clearly a politically motivated action by the Nevada bar at a time when the Attorney General, Adam Laxalt, was running for future office to target three of his senior attorneys on what is just an obviously unfair and incorrect theory under the rules. Now, the Attorney General of Montana has his own situation that you may have heard of, Austin Knutson. This has been dragging on for quite some time, and it relates to very contentious litigation between the legislature in Montana and the Supreme Court about the legislature changing some of the rules and regulations governing the court system in Montana, including how they were to select judicial nominees. That resulted in fraught litigation that went up to the Montana Supreme Court about a series of emails, and there were arguments about the motivations of judges that was in that litigation. So these are statements about the judges potentially being biased. And you might think that that sounds unusual, but in this case, the literal subject of the litigation was about emails that judges took where they put out their opinion that pending legislation was unconstitutional before they heard the cases. It's really in the form of a motion to recuse a judge for open bias. After that fight ended, it ended in a cert petition that did not prevail at the U.S. Supreme Court or get granted. The legislature essentially lost that fight in the court system in Montana. A California lawyer who happened to be barred in Montana filed a complaint and said that the rhetoric and arguments used by the attorney general's lawyers violated Rule 8.2 for impugning the integrity of a judge, violated Rule 3.4 when they declined to file an ex parte TRO that didn't have legal basis. And it also violated the catch-all provision that it was prejudicial to the administration of justice. This is all litigation that happened in 2021. There were 2 years of investigation. So the public didn't even know about this pending complaint investigation for 2 years. The first investigator refused to press charges under these aggressive theories of the Montana attorney regulation rules. Effectively, the first investigator was fired, and they found a new investigator who, shock of shocks, returned 164 count complaint against the attorney general. That was litigated up through the attorney practice individuals in Montana, and they ultimately found and recommended that the attorney general himself should be disbarred for 90 days as a sanction for this conduct. And just to give you a sense of how political this has been, that opinion from the Attorney Regulation Commission in Montana, it came out a week before the attorney general was up for reelection. They effectively rushed it out to try to make a public spectacle of this before his election. The opinion is a remarkable work of sloppiness and laziness. It cites a single legal decision in this opinion saying that the sitting attorney general should be disbarred for 90 days, Marbury versus Madison, for the proposition that the attorney general is not above the law. And so that is currently on appeal in the Montana Supreme Court. They had oral argument in the case 4 months ago. It's a waiting decision. There's been some change in composition of the Montana Supreme Court. So perhaps the attorney general will be allowed to keep his law license when he continues to be the attorney general for the state of Montana. There's a whole host of separation of powers concerns here, but it is, again, another example of a very weaponized attorney discipline process being used to go after attorneys simply for the positions that they've advocated in cases. And the last thing I would note is I'm aware that private attorneys, not just government attorneys, are being targeted by aggressive ethical investigations. One friend of mine has been investigated for years now by the DC bar. And I want to highlight the lack of due process that is endemic to this system. The DC bar office is regularly using ex parte subpoenas with threats of gag orders to prevent those who are being investigated from having any sort of process or awareness or ability to challenge subpoenas, including for attorney-client privilege. And that's just disturbing conduct. And you know, think about Lawrence Van Dyke's situation. You're told your bar license is gone in 2 days with no opportunity for a hearing. I mean, in what court would that fly under any legal theory of due process? So I think it's a due process free zone that we have. I took a quick look. I didn't find any Democrat attorney generals who have been recommended for disbarment for the wordings used in their briefs. And it seems like all we have are hostile prosecutors who are ideologically or politically motivated in a system that is really stacked against anybody who's remotely conservative. And it's easy to ignore that it's not happening to you, but it's happening frequently enough across the country, not just in DC, that I think we need to seriously take a look at it. And if possible, get the US Supreme Court to dive in, because they've been very reluctant to do anything about the regulation of attorneys, but it appears the attorneys are not capable of regulating themselves.
Thanks, Michael. I have a feeling we'll circle back to the due process questions that you're raising later in our discussion. Let's go to you next, Gene. Would you give us your opening remarks on this?
Yeah, of course. Thanks. And really good points by my fellow panelists today. As always, with James Burnham, we share a lot of the same kind of positions and points. I was going to speak briefly to one of the issues that James rose, which is the McDade Amendment, which is the, you know, the attempt by Congress to somehow subject executive branch attorneys to the disciplinary authorities of applicable states and maybe D.C. Bar authorities. And look, maybe that has application in certain contexts, but, you know, I think if not entirely as applied in certain scenarios, it's certainly unconstitutional. If you're trying to subject an executive branch attorney who is providing advice and recommendations to the president of the United States, I don't know how Congress could attempt to subject a bar regulator, some bar bureaucrat, to be able to make a judgment call about the advice and the recommendations that are made by an attorney working for the executive branch. So that it's a really thorny constitutional issue. And quite frankly, I think it's one that we need to see play out. And I think we need to see it play out in a big way here in the very near future. Because Congress doesn't need to be in the business of passing unconstitutional statutes. There's other mechanisms to hold government lawyers accountable for misconduct, principally by the government. There's a chain of command, and they can be removed for lying and fraud and deceit. And so when you think about the purpose, what is the purpose of such a provision, or what is the purpose of something like Rule 8.4 that is replicated throughout most state bar rule regimes? Generally speaking, it's to protect the integrity of the practice of law, generally. But it's not just to protect this kind of nebulous integrity. It's really oriented towards protecting the public and ensuring that the public is dealing with people who have candor and they are honest, and they're not going to betray a client, and so that the judges and other practitioners have the ability to trust and to understand that the representations that are being made on the other side or by the parties in front of a tribunal are honest, they're trustworthy, they're good faith arguments to zealously advocate for a client. But what they're not intended to be, and I don't think anybody, if you had gone back to when these rules were being adopted, or even some of their predecessors, or even, and this would actually be a great paper at some point for somebody in academia to look at, kind of the history of the regulation of the practice of law in different states, and to see under what circumstances then were just arbitrary members of the public able to pick up the newspaper or read something on their X feed, say, I don't like what that guy is saying. It seems like a lie. I'm going to file a bar complaint. I'm going to subject this person to hell from some investigation because I think that what they were doing is lying. I have no personal knowledge of the facts. I have no personal awareness of anything that was ongoing. And yet that's basically what we saw with the 65 Project. I don't have to put the words in their mouth. You can go right to their website and you can look. They filed over 90 complaints against various attorneys, not based on anything that they experienced themselves or that they witnessed or the cases that they were a part of uniquely. It was reading stories in the newspaper and targeting people and trying to act as a deterrent to people falsely advocating for certain types of clients. Now, the 65 Project, of course, now it still exists on paper, or at least their website's still up. It's not actually a real nonprofit organization. It's a fiscally sponsored project, but it's morphed. And now they have this Legal Accountability Center, again, a fiscally sponsored project of another 501c4. The same players involved, the same people that were involved in the 65 Project filing complaints against people in the post-2020 election are now involved in filing complaints against Department of Justice attorneys in the Donald Trump administration based on the same types of allegations. Oh, I saw something. I heard something. I saw what you filed in court. That seems dishonest. They have no knowledge of the underlying facts, no personal awareness. And I just don't think that if we look at a historical development of the regulation of practice of law, that would have ever been envisioned by the people who were drafting these rules of professional conduct, that would be a viable way to help regulate the practice of law and to ensure that it stays self-regulating. I can assure you the one way to assure that it will not continue to be a self-regulating practice, a self-regulating profession, is to permit and to allow this kind of weaponization of the rules of professional conduct against other people just based on disagreements. Now, I have a client that I represented in the last year. Some of you will know Stefan Passantino, who was on the receiving end of one of these bar complaints filed by the 65 Project. That ended up being totally baseless and tossed out. So we filed a bar complaint against the head of the 65 Project based on our client, Stefan's experiences, based on our personal knowledge and awareness of what he went through and the way in which that complaint being filed against Stefan was a violation in and of itself, according to our complaint, according to our reading of the rules, of the rules of professional conduct. So it's never been intended for lawyers to weaponize bar rules against each other. There's supposed to be this candor. There's supposed to be this recognition, mutual respect for your adversary, and agree to disagree, zealously advocate, and go home. But that's apparently no longer good enough for a lot of members of the legal profession, and they are out for personal destruction of people with whom they disagree. So I think that we really have to ask ourselves as a profession, as a self-governing body, is this permissible conduct that we're seeing? Is this the kind of thing that leads to a better and more just society to file baseless complaints against other lawyers based on pure disagreements, based on disagreements on the interpretation of law? And I think the answer to that should be fairly clear to most folks on this call. So how do we get from where we are today to a world in which we don't have to deal with these things anymore? I think that we should look at modifications to the rules governing the state bars. State bars should also zealously guard their grievance procedures, and they should require some modicum of personal knowledge, some modicum of some personal involvement with the matter, to be able to take disciplinary actions against an attorney, because it's not just the end result that these advocates care about. They don't just care about getting somebody disbarred, which of course I think for a lot of them say, well, this would be wonderful. It's to chill. It's to chill the willingness to take on certain kinds of cases and certain types of clients, and then to put them through the pain of the process that's associated with going through a disciplinary proceeding, all the money, all the time, all the expenses that are associated with it. And that's harassing to another attorney, if anything ever possibly could be. And in certain contexts, you can imagine arguments in which, depending on the players and depending on the actors involved, this could amount to a conspiracy to deprive of rights. I think that's going to be an interesting thing that we'll see play out over time. But, you know, really, really and truly, to see these rules that are intended to govern and just ensure that we're dealing with each other with candor, that when you submit a filing in a court proceeding, that you can trust the other person on the other side of the V, and the judges can trust the parties before them, and that members of the general public can trust the representations that are being made by their own attorneys, into a world in which we use these rules to weaponize against each other. I think that we've really gone astray. And so there's a lot of course correction that needs to take place. I think there's some drastic actions that are going to have to be taken to stop this abusive practice. And I think that the state bars should spend their time instead taking a look at other areas of the law and other places where actual misconduct and fraud and misrepresentation and taking advantage of clients is endemic. Really and truly, if anyone spent any time in the practice of immigration law, that is one of the areas that is more rife with fraud and abuse and taking advantage of clients and not having good faith arguments for an extension or modification of the law. And yet these things go unaddressed. So we have state bar associations focusing entirely on the wrong things, entirely missing massive abuses of the profession and the practice of law. And really and truly, it's very sad to see the state that we're in today.
Appreciate that additional context, Gene. And I hope the academics in the virtual room wrote down your suggestion for sort of a law review article or future research on the history of attorney regulation, because I think that's an interesting point. Derek, let's go to you. Tell us more things we should be concerned with or help us alleviate some of our concerns.
Sure. Well, thanks. It's a privilege to be a part of this panel. And I'm cognizant, you know, Michael talks about the things that keep him up at night. And as a law professor in the ivory tower, I understand that my practice of law, which is essentially non-existent, looks very different from the boots on the ground approach, thinking about the concerns that attorneys have when it comes to the practice of law and the concerns about discipline. So I want to highlight some points of agreement, I think, and some of the overarching themes that I think are major ones going forward, but also, you know, sort of drill down on a couple of things with respect to allegations of facts before a tribunal and the duty of candor. You know, I think there have been some really important procedural issues identified here at the outset, especially I think James's points with respect to the Department of Justice are really important framing issues. Likewise, Gene's points about just about anybody filing a complaint. I think the biggest problem when we think about these complaints being filed, or maybe not the biggest, but one of the biggest ones, that is, can be anybody off the street. And typically we don't allow people off the street to file complaints in the courts. That's a generalized grievance. And the federal courts very much do not hear those kinds of things. Usually you have to identify some sort of tangible way in which you were affected. And so there are the situations where the client is affected and might file that complaint, or situations where the adverse party in the case might file that complaint or file a Rule 11 motion for sanctions, things like that. So it might be different in kind and the kinds of reforms we might want to think about rather than just allowing anybody off the street. And we've seen this happen a lot in other situations with better outcomes. I mean, still harassment, but better outcomes, right? Where Justices Thomas and Kavanaugh accused of acts or conduct that subjected them to deluges of complaints to the bar or to the disciplinary tribunals. Judge William Pryor on the 11th Circuit hiring a clerk, and his decision to hire that clerk was subject to a bar complaint. I mean, there are all kinds of things that are just this kind of bar fare where people read something in the news about somebody they don't like and file a complaint, which results in harassment. It's a real problem. Additionally, when we think particularly about election litigation, sort of my universe of things, we have to be particularly sensitive in that context, especially after an election, about what is happening in terms of the fog of war. That is, elections are very compressed in their timeline, particularly for elections of an executive, whether it's a president or a governor. There's real concerns that the failure to file complaints early yields mootness problems, yields latches problems. But at the same time, we know there's an ongoing duty to supplement those claims, to revise those assumptions in the midst of that fog of war. If we think about Bush versus Gore, and back in 2000, we had Al Gore didn't know a whole lot of what was going on when it came to the counting of ballots, but was filing recounts, was filing contests, was filing motions using ambiguous state statutes, again, in ways that maybe were not consistent with a generalized understanding at the time, but needed to preserve those issues. It was ultimately successful, at least for a time, on some of those issues. And likewise, the Bush campaign was pushing back with fairly novel legal theories, I would argue, at the time, things that were not well established at the time, but we wanted the attorneys to be able to raise those points. And sure enough, the Supreme Court, a majority on one claim, three justices on another, agreed with the Bush campaign on some of these issues. We want to be able to have those clients zealously represented in the fog of war, in a highly contentious, highly uncertain situation, and be able to represent before the court the things that they know about, but also as the case goes along and as the facts change, to be able to back off from some of those and move on to the other things where the key issues are still being preserved. Another is that when we think about these bar complaints, we have to think about proportional discipline. I think this is an important factor to think about. So with one of the complaints that was discussed, right, there was a divide among some of those on the tribunal. One side, the majority side, essentially saying complete disbarment for a single false statement, and a dissenting view that said, look, when we talk about flagrant views, we typically think that flagrant views are not just about the importance of the matter, but about the pattern of conduct. And so if we're going to have disproportionate kinds of penalties based upon sort of novel interpretations of the disciplinary codes, then I think that's a separate and independent problem that we need to be considering. And understandably, people very upset about certain things after the 2020 election, and very upset about the litigation that took place about that. But thinking about proportional discipline or proportional consequences is a pretty significant one. So sort of two last points to think about. One is, you know, it has not been so long ago that we would really come down, or at least some of us might have really come down, on misrepresentations of lawyers to a tribunal and thinking that it was a matter of some significant importance. And while we're spending a lot of time on sort of one side of the aisle, I do want to point out there was a former president who was punished with 5 years of disbarment by the Bar of Arkansas for misleading the court with respect to a question about the term, quote, sexual relations, unquote. And that was a 5-year disciplinary consequence from the State Bar of Arkansas. So there are those kinds of consequences that flow from misrepresentations being made to the court with respect to facts. And one of the things that we've seen from, I think, a lot of these things, especially after the 2020 election, is a lot of focus on facts and not law. In some of the jurisdictions, there were efforts to say that the legal theories, whether it's extensions of Bush versus Gore, extensions of the legislature thereof clause, or things like that, many of the tribunals have backed away from finding that those are the things that should be subject to discipline and sanction. That is, that novel legal theories are the things that we do not really want to punish. And especially even if they're uncertain or untried or untested, for the most part, they've moved away from those misrepresentations of law as the basis for allegations and more toward misrepresentations of fact. But when it comes to misrepresentations of fact, right, it's very difficult if you're dealing with reckless or knowingly. These are not unknown terms in the criminal world. And there's no question that it is a challenge for any disciplinary authority to try to suss out the mens rea of those who are making the statements. And when it comes to factual allegations, again, we have to realize that there's a wide timeline of things that we're talking about. There's a difference between factual allegations with respect to alleged improprieties in the 2020 election on November 9th, from November 19th to December 28th to January 2nd. There's different sort of knowledge, different awareness, different investigation that has taken place. So I think it's also crucial. We can sort of run that all together and say, well, it was sort of the fog of war was the totality of sort of the post-COVID, post-election universe. But I think there were developments in the weeks afterward that made some people who were skeptical of the results earlier in November to realize, assess the evidence and come to different conclusions. And so as a result, I think it's helpful for the bar to be thinking specifically about the knowledge at that time, not just what other people have said, but the evidence that was presented and whether or not there was contemporaneous evidence presented beyond just sort of generalized statements or mental impressions or whatever it might be. Again, we can ask ourselves about the seriousness of those factual allegations. There's major procedural problems that we might have. But I do think with respect to factual allegations, updating your priors and trying to make sure that you're representing things with candor to the tribunal, updating your priors with respect to the weeks of investigation that had happened prior to some of the allegations is a material concern, I think, for these bars that are investigating some of the complaints. Doesn't obviate many of the procedural concerns, but just one of the things that I wanted to flag as well. So I appreciate the panel, appreciate the conversation.
Thanks, that's great. We all have raised an array of concerns manifesting in a variety of ways. So I think jumping off of what Gene mentioned about the need for course correction, I'd love to just go down the line and pose the same question to each one of you, which is, what procedural or constitutional safeguards do exist to protect lawyers against viewpoint discrimination by state licensing authorities? Are these tools sufficient for the current moment, or do we need something different? James, I'll start with you.
Yeah, I mean, the thing I've thought about the most, and I can't say I've thought about it a ton, is the federal angle. And I think this has become an issue that the Justice Department will need to do something about, because its own lawyers are under, I mean, Jeff was under assault, has been under assault for a while, and now more lawyers are under assault from these bar associations. And it is the sort of thing that if it is not stopped basically quickly, could easily metastasize and have a seriously negative effect on the department's ability to do its job and to provide capable representation of the executive branch, capable advice to the president. So, you know, I think there could be federal supremacy arguments. I think there could be separation of powers arguments. I alluded to some of those before. And, you know, I'm confident that the current Justice Department, which is as understaffed and overworked as any DOJ has ever been, will, you know, be able to come up with some of this stuff. On the rest of it, look, I think the people on this call and the people who are concerned about this should put their heads together. There are obviously good arguments. I think there are probably good arguments. I mean, for one thing, you have a First Amendment right to not be persecuted or have your livelihood taken away based on your viewpoint. And so the bar is no different from any other governmental entity or quasi-governmental entity. It cannot do that. And so if you have a strong claim that it is, I think that's something that you could go to court to try to vindicate. And by court, I mean federal court, not the state court where the bar operates under the aegis of. So those are just some ideas.
Thanks. Michael, but what about you? Do you think there are any effective remedies out there right now that can help protect lawyers against bar fare?
Nobody told me I came with solutions to this webinar. I think the application of constitutional law to the state bar process needs to be taken more seriously by the federal courts. I mean, it was only recently, relatively speaking, that they allowed the First Amendment to allow attorneys to advertise. And I think generally the court's attitude has been to let attorneys regulate themselves. And I don't think from a due process or a First Amendment perspective that that's going to continue to be viable in the future. I'm not professional ethics attorney, but a lot of this process to me screams out for reasonable reform at the state level, if that's possible with these captured bars. I mean, the fact that you have complaints about factual assertions or claims and pleadings by non-parties that result in sometimes years and hundreds of thousands of dollars of harassment by the attorneys is just madness. I mean, the courts can police themselves. In like Attorney General Knudsen's case, for instance, there was never a motion to bring sanctions. There was never a motion to show cause. All of the conduct they're complaining of took place in the courts, and the courts weren't evidently bothered by that conduct. And yet you've got 4 years of bar fare that takes place after that, again, because some California attorney filed a complaint. And I think that that kind of reform maybe needs to happen at the state level, but at a minimum, there's some constitutional protections that should be more vigorously enforced. You know, nobody wants to bring those cases. You just want to get your job back when you're in this situation. But I also think the courts are a little bit to blame for not taking these cases seriously.
Gene, where can we find refuge?
It's a great question. I kind of inferred it something earlier, or at least explicitly maybe have mentioned it, but I really do think that each of the state bar associations need to take a really hard look at their rules and to modify them to prevent abuses of the disciplinary process, to ensure that there is some factual or personal knowledge that is required before the submission of a complaint. There has to be a gatekeeping function there. And that's just the lowest hanging fruit, addressing one aspect of what we've been talking about today. I think that is a bare minimum requirement. There's a lot of due process issues also that we ought to have the bar associations consider. You know, it seems odd that an attorney in a self-regulating discipline would be afforded less due process than, you know, a criminal defendant. I mean, I get the stakes are different, of course, right? And we're talking about the deprivation of liberty by the hands of the state. But the deprivation of the ability to provide for yourself, to engage in conduct that would be covered in many cases by the First Amendment, it seems to me to be a very big problem that people have to consider. I share James's view. Department of Justice has a strong incentive to act here, to protect its own people who are being subjected to unfounded complaints based on their zealous representation of their client. And I think that they need to come out swiftly and strongly to stop this stuff. It's garbage. It's garbage, the notion that there's some 501c4 that is going to act as the valiant savior of the legal profession. And it's going to stop bad things from happening by filing bar complaints against attorneys who dare to represent their client. Of course, this is coming from the same person who ran advertisements last fall. You can look them up. October of last year, they were running newspaper advertisements, the 65 Project, saying, warning lawyers, don't lose your law license by working for Donald Trump. This is stuff that they're trying to have a chilling effect. That is not constructive for the practice of law. So there has to be a gatekeeping function that is played by the state bars. But I think there has to be a heavy hammer at some point. And there has to be a point at which, again, depending upon the actors involved, depending on the factual circumstances, where people have to seriously consider whether or not there are conspiracies to deprive lawyers of their rights under law. We cannot just kind of pussyfoot around the situation. We have to take this squarely on. If we care about the rule of law and we care about the preservation of an adversarial system where there is an independent adjudicator at the top of it, who's adjudicating cases and controversies brought before them, we have to make sure that we maintain the integrity of the process. And we, by maintaining the integrity, we're not allowing it to be weaponized against each other. We should not stand for the weaponization of disciplinary rules against other lawyers, regardless of our views of their own beliefs, their own clients, anything else. That just, to me, runs contrary to everything that I ever learned as a law student, as a young lawyer, about the obligations of an attorney to zealously advocate for their client. So I think there has to be solutions. I think it has to be multifaceted. But we have to engage in the dialogue to start working on those solutions now.
Derek, same question to you. Just, you alluded to it a little bit, but in a nutshell, what is the strongest legal defense against barfare?
I mean, just very briefly, I think there is a distinction to be made, or at least to think about reform for those things that are representations to the court versus those things that are not, that are sort of out in the wild. And so a couple of them that we've already hit on, right? How should we think about internal memoranda, as James is pointing out, or how do we think about things like statements at press conferences or political rallies or things like that? Again, some of these are subject of examination and litigation. And, you know, I think there's real First Amendment issues, or there's real thoughts about the ability of lawyers to zealously advocate for their clients when it's internal issues. I think that could really speak to those matters. And when it comes to, in contrast, litigation, statements made in the course of litigation, you know, I think state bars probably need to start having a really hard assessment of the relationship of something like Rule 3.1 in many jurisdictions and Rule 11 or its equivalent in the course of litigation. That is, if the opponent has not filed that sort of Rule 11 motion or requested you to retract what it deems to be a factual misrepresentation, if the adversary in the process with the most to gain doesn't do that, you know, how should we think about the ability of Joe Smith off the street to show up 6 months, a year, 2 years later, and then file essentially materially identical claims, as Rule 11 would say, under 3.1 to the licensing authority and essentially say, no, now you need to step in and discipline them, even though as a part of this litigation, it didn't happen. There is a sense in which if lawyers in their professional ethical conduct decide that some things are not worth seeking sanctions in the course of litigation, I mean, that to me is sort of a sign that maybe there's a reason why we can let the attorneys sort of duke it out in court rather than it being the subject of a bar complaint. So I don't know. I don't have a great idea on that, except to think about that there's probably some relationship between Rule 11 and 3.1 to think about going forward. And for bars to maybe be a little bit more hesitant in the absence of the sort of judicial tribunal adjudication of these kinds of disputes.
Great. Well, we have an abundance of questions in the chat, so many. So I'll pivot to that now. We have a lot that are sort of asking the same kind of question. So just combining them, one of the question themes is about mandatory versus voluntary bar associations. Derek, I know you've given some thought to what would happen in the absence of the ABA or bar association. So what would making state bars voluntary, and this is for you, Derek, would that be a way to solve this issue of potential viewpoint targeting, or do you think it's just going to inevitably pop up in some other format?
Yeah, I mean, you're still going to have to be admitted to the bar. And the question is, who's the one that's principally responsible for the discipline, whether it's starting with the bar association and then being appealed to the state courts, or whether it's being held in house to the state courts. So, I mean, I don't have great thoughts on this. Maybe others who deal much more directly with these matters have thoughts. The one point I will say is, right, I think, you know, consistent with a lot of Federalist Society conversations since issues like Abood or other kinds of compelled speech cases, compelled association cases, I think there's been a move to suggest, right, that there shouldn't be these sort of forced associations with bar associations, that these should be voluntary associations. And maybe that's a reform in some sort of litigation coming in the next decade. But I'm not sure it necessarily solves the problem. It just might relocate the problem. Now, maybe relocating it is better. I don't know, but I'll let others think about it.
Well, something in the news last week seems to have caught a lot of people's attention, which was a Ninth Circuit dissent from a denial of en banc review related to a district court's sanctioning of attorneys that, in the district court's words, was to, quote, send a message to litigants not to bring certain types of election-related disputes. So Judge Van Dyke was in the dissent, so maybe I'll pitch this to you, Michael. Do you see that case as part of the politically tinged actions that we're seeing with the state bars? Do you think this is part of bar fear, or is there a reason to worry about courts also taking shots at lawyers and misabusing Rule 11 sanctions? Or do you think that the Rule 11 sanctions are not really a component of the bar fear that we're seeing?
I'm sure if the courts start more vigorously enforcing Rule 11 in those ways, we'll have a panel in a year or so about that process as well. Rule 11 sanctions can be problematic, certainly, but it's a different type of problem that we're dealing with here, where you take an attorney's livelihood and their license to practice law, and you put that on line in a disciplinary process that is very fraught with lack of protection. So it's its own problem with Rule 11 potentially, but it's a different type of problem than I think this problem.
So maybe I'll follow up with you on this and maybe get some other panelists input too. But one question is there a reason to think that this is an actual trend versus just kind of one-off incidents that are happening in different places at different times? And if it is a trend, when did it start? Why? What are the political forces behind this bar fair, if it really is a thing?
So, Denise, I also I saw a lot of people are asking about Professor Eastman, and so I thought that might be a good time to kind of touch on that, including one person I'm usually very responsive to. He knows who he is. But so, look, I think the trend, I noticed it after the 2020 election because everyone lost their minds, and you know, after the sort of the president left office, there was obviously, I mean, this is not news, a concerted effort to go after anyone who was involved in sort of contesting the election results. And Professor Eastman is obviously a good example of that. I don't know his case as well as I know Jeff's. But I mean, the basic allegations, as I understand it, are that he, you know, came up with a strategy to subvert the election. And it's a lot of like hortatory nonsense. You know, it talks about stuff he said in a public speech. It talks about having, you know, crazy legal theories. Folks, when we're talking about constitutional theories about the vice president's role in tabulating electoral votes, it's pretty hard to say that something is crazy or unfounded. These are not settled areas of law. We're not talking about, you know, alleging a tort while, you know, intentionally omitting one element of the tort. We're talking about creative constitutional lawyering. And it's the kind of thing where I just think it's like obviously not the sort of thing that the state bar should be trying to destroy somebody's livelihood over. And the only thing I'll say is, like, the most politicized situations are the ones where the bar should be the most reticent, not the most eager. When everybody's worked up and we're talking about, you know, John Adams defending the Boston Massacre of British soldiers, like that's when lawyers are supposed to be the most creative and the most aggressive. Will they win in court or lose in court? You know, that's what the court's going to decide. But it's not the kind of situation where you want lawyers to be afraid need to even engage in advocacy in the first place, particularly in that context. We had the sitting president contesting the election against the potential next president. That's where you should want lawyers to be rushing to the field. We need lawyers. If there are no lawyers, then it's just going to devolve into chaos and combat. And that is, of course, the absolute opposite of what you should want in a civilized country. So those are my sort of emotional, if not super well-informed thoughts on Professor East.
That's great. Well, I'll give you the last word, Gene, just building on that. So we know the ABA and other licensing bodies have disciplined John Eastman, Rudy Giuliani, Sidney Powell, now Jeff Clark. To what extent do these reflect enforcement of professional norms? Is there any argument that these were actually, you know, proper application of professional regulations? Or if it is pure political pressure, where exactly is it coming from?
Well, it's a really good question. I think it depends on who you ask, of course. I'm sure the bar disciplinary members of each of the respective bars think that they were doing a great duty and a great civic civic duty for the general public. And I think that if you ask the average commentator on the evening news on MSNBC, they'd probably think that it was fabulous. But I don't think that any reasonable person who is sober-minded and thinks about things and thinks about the stakes that James really highlighted, you think about the stakes in which passions are inflamed, the kind of the role of courts in society, the role of a tribunal, an impartial tribunal in society, its duty is to make sure that we resort to courts so that we can peacefully adjudicate disputes. We don't need to get to a place where people say, well, I can't make that argument in court because I'm going to lose my law license, even though it seems colorable. It's actually, we have some good arguments, but they're going to come after my law license and I can't do it. Well, what does that mean for the non-members of the bar? How are they going to remedy their situations then? And, you know, I don't want to see that world. I think that we all have to respect and preserve and maintain the integrity of the profession and to be able to go home and agree to disagree at the end of the day, at the end of a case. But I don't think that that's really the mindset of a lot of people who are making these complaints, who are weaponizing these proceedings, have kind of a, I don't know if you call it like a Napoleonic complex or a savior complex, who think that they are going to be the person who protects and preserves, you know, this nebulous notion of democracy by taking out another lawyer based on the arguments that they make. So, you know, we could go on for a long time. I know we're kind of over time now, and I want to be respectful of everybody's schedules. But I would just say that I think we really have to be very sober-minded. The bar associations really have to be very sober-minded as they approach these various complaints, as they look at the disciplinary process, and that they just remember what it was like when they were learning about the practice of law, when they were in law school, when they were young lawyers, and they were being advised and instructed about the kind of the duty and the ultimate role of the lawyer in society. And if we're weaponizing bar proceedings against one person, regardless of the motivations behind it, regardless of the money behind it, regardless of the actors behind it, we've fallen short. And there has to be a change, and we have to make a change. And so I would implore all of the bar associations across the country today to start making those changes.
Well, that is a powerful word to end on for today. This will definitely be an ongoing conversation. So thank you to all of our panelists, to our audience, and to the Federalist Society for being part of today's event.
And I want to second the thanks for that fantastic discussion and the benefit of your expertise today. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I'd also like to thank you, our audience, for joining us. We greatly appreciate your participation. For information on more upcoming events, please visit our website or all major social media platforms at FedSoc. On that note, we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. For more information about the Federalist Society, the practice groups, and to become a Federalist Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.